brought up a difficult question, and he had ducked it. And here she was, at the age of 6, trying to piece together the greatest puzzle of life.
Daddy?
Yes, darling. He held his breath.
You know Mrs. Winston's bicycle?
Mrs. Winston's bicycle? Then he remembered. 2 years ago, at Campbell's nursery school, there had been a teacher named Mrs. Winston who braved the traffic and rode a bicycle to school every day. All the children had thought this was wonderful, a teacher who rode a bicycle to school. He had never heard Campbell mention the woman since then. Oh, yes, I remember. An anxious pause.
Mackenzie has one just like it.
Mackenzie? Mackenzie Reed was a little girl in Campbell's class. She does?
Yes, only it's smaller.
Sherman waited for the leap of logic, but it never came. That was it. God lives, God is dead, Mrs. Winston's bicycle, no way Jose, no say ho. They all came out of the same heap in the toy box. Sherman was relieved for a moment, but then he felt cheated. The thought that his daughter might actually have questioned the existence of God at the age of 6, this he had taken as a sign of superior intelligence. Over the past 10 years on the Upper East Side, for the first time, intelligence had become socially correct for girls. Several little girls in burgundy jumpers and their parents or nannies were assembled at the Tolliver bus stop on the other side of Park Avenue. As soon as Campbell saw them, she tried to remove her hand from Sherman's. She had reached that age, but he wouldn't let her. He held her hand tightly and led her across the street. He was her protector. He glowered at a taxi as it came to a noisy stop at the light. He would gladly throw himself in front of it, if that was what it would take to save Campbell's life. As they crossed Park Avenue, he had a mental picture of what an ideal pair they made. Campbell, the perfect angel in a private school uniform, himself, with his noble head, his Yale chin, his big frame, and his $1,800 British suit, the angel's father, a man of parts. He visualized the admiring stares, the envious stares, of the drivers, the pedestrians, of one and all. As soon as they reached the bus stop, Campbell pulled free. The parents who brought their girls to the Tolliver bus stop in the morning were a cheery bunch. What a chipper mood they were always in. Sherman began saying his good mornings. Edith Tompkins, John Channing, Mackenzie Reed's mother, Kirby Coleman's nanny, Leonard Shorsky, Mrs. Luger. When he got to Mrs. Luger, he had never known her first name, he did a double take. She was a thin, pale, blonde woman who never wore makeup. This morning, she must have rushed down to the bus stop with her daughter at the last minute. She was wearing a man's blue button-down shirt with the top two buttons unbuttoned. She had on a pair of old blue jeans and some ballet slippers. The jeans were very tight. She had a terrific little body. He had never noticed that before. Really, quite terrific. She looked so pale and half-awake and vulnerable. You know, what you need is a cup of coffee, Mrs. Luger. Come on, I'm going over to that coffee shop on Lexington. Oh, that's silly, Mr. McCoy. Come on up to the apartment. I have some coffee already made. He stared at her for a good 2 seconds longer than he should have, and then, pop! The bus arrived. A big, solid, greyhound-size vehicle, and the children bounded up the steps. Sherman turned away, then looked back at Mrs. Luger, but she wasn't looking at him. She was walking toward her apartment building. The back seam of her jeans practically clove her in two. There were whitish spots on either side of the seat. They were like highlights for the flesh that welled up underneath. What a marvelous bottom she had! And he had always thought of these women as moms. Who knew what hot little fires burned within these moms? Sherman started walking east, toward the taxi stand at First Avenue and 79th Street. He felt buoyant. Just why, he couldn't have explained. The discovery of the lovely little Mrs. Luger, Yes, but in fact he always left the bus stop in a good mood. The best school, the best girls, the best families, the best section of the capital of the Western world in the late 20th century. But the only part that stuck in his mind was the sensation of Campbell's little hand holding his. That was why he felt so good. The touch of her trusting, utterly dependent little hand was life itself. Then his spirits sank. He was walking along at a good clip, his eyes idly panning the facades of the brownstone houses. On this gray morning, they looked old and depressing, shapeless polyethylene bags of trash in shades of dogshit brown and turd green were deposited in front of them out by the curbs. The bags had a slimy-looking surface. How could people live this way? Just two blocks away was Maria's apartment. Ralston Thorpe's was around here somewhere. Sherman and Raleigh had gone to Buckley, St. Paul's, and Yale together, and now they both worked at Pierce and Pierce. Raleigh had moved from a 16-room apartment on Fifth Avenue to the top two floors of a brownstone somewhere along here after his divorce. Very depressing. Sherman had taken a nice big step toward a divorce last night, hadn't he? Not only had Judy caught him, in flagrante telephone, as it were, but then he, abject creature of lust that he was, had gone ahead and gotten laid. Right. Nothing more than that. Laid. And not returned home for 45 minutes. What would it do to Campbell if he and Judy ever broke up? He couldn't imagine his life after such a thing. Weekend visitation rights with his own daughter? What was that phrase they used? Quality time? So tawdry, so tawdry. Campbell's soul hardening month by month into a brittle little shell. By the time he had gone half a block, he hated himself. He felt like turning around and heading back to the apartment and begging forgiveness and swearing never again. He felt like it, but he knew he wouldn't do it. That would make him late getting to the office, which was much frowned upon at Pierce and Pierce. No one ever said anything openly, but you were supposed to get there early and start making money and master the universe. A surge of adrenaline. The Giscard. He was closing in on the biggest deal of his life, the Giscard, the gold-backed bond, master of the universe. Then he sank again. Judy had slept on the daybed in the dressing room of their bedroom suite. She was still asleep, or pretending to be, when he got up. Well, thank God for that. He hadn't relished another round with her this morning, especially with Campbell or Bonita listening in. Bonita was one of those South American servants with perfectly pleasant but nonetheless formal demeanors. To display temper or anguish in front of her would be a gaffe. No wonder marriages used to hold up better. Sherman's parents and their friends had all had plenty of servants, and the servants had worked long hours and lived in. If you were unwilling to argue in front of the servants, then there wasn't much opportunity to argue at all. So, in the best McCoy manner, just as his father would have done it, except that he couldn't imagine his father ever being in such a jam, Sherman had kept up appearances. He had breakfast in the kitchen with Campbell while Bonita got her through breakfast and ready for school. Bonita had a portable television set in the kitchen, and she kept turning toward it to watch the news report of the riot in Harlem. It was hot stuff, but Sherman hadn't paid attention to it. It had all seemed so remote, the sort of thing that happened out there, among those people. He had been busy trying to pump out charm and cheeriness so that Bonita and Campbell wouldn't sense the poisonous atmosphere that enveloped the household. By now, Sherman had walked as far as Lexington Avenue. He always stopped at a candy store near the corner and bought the Times. As he turned the corner, a girl was heading toward him, a tall girl with a lot of blonde hair. A large handbag hung from her shoulder by a strap. She was walking rapidly, as if heading for the subway at 77th Street. She had on a long sweater that was wide open down the front, revealing a polo shirt with a little embroidered emblem over the left breast. She wore some sort of go-to-hell white pants that were very loose and floppy in the legs, but exceptionally tight in the crotch. Exceptionally. There was an astonishing crevice. Sherman stared, and then looked at her face. She stared right back. She looked him right in the eye and smiled. She didn't slow down or give him a provocative look. It was a confident, optimistic look that as much as said, "Hi, we're a couple of good-looking animals, aren't we?" So frank, so unabashed, so eagerly immodest. In the candy store, after paying for the Times, Sherman turned to go out the door and his eyes swept across a magazine rack. The salmon flesh jumped out at him. Girls, boys, girls with girls, boys with boys, girls with boys, girls with bare breasts, girls with bare bottoms, girls with paraphernalia. A happy, grinning riot of pornography, a rout, an orgy, a hog wallow. On the cover of one magazine is a girl wearing only a pair of high-heeled shoes and a loincloth, except that it isn't a loincloth, it's a snake. Somehow, it's wedged in her groin and looking right at Sherman. She's looking right at him, too. On her face is the sunniest, most unaffected smile imaginable. It's the face of the girl who serves you a chocolate chip ice cream cone at the Baskin-Robbins. Sherman resumed his walk toward First Avenue in a state of agitation. It was in the air. It was a wave, everywhere, inescapable. Sex. There for the taking. It walked down the street, as bold as you please. It was splashed all over the shops. If you were a young man and halfway alive, what chance did you have? Technically, he had been unfaithful to his wife. Well, sure, but who could remain monogamous with this tidal wave of concupiscence rolling across the world? Christ almighty, a master of the universe couldn't be a saint after all. It was unavoidable. For Christ's sake, you can't dodge snowflakes, and this was a blizzard. He had merely been caught at it, that was all, or halfway caught at it. It meant nothing. It had no moral dimension. It was nothing more than getting soaking wet. By the time he reached the cab stand at 1st and 79th, he had just about worked it out in his mind. At 79th Street and 1st Avenue, the taxis lined up every day to take the young masters of the universe down to Wall Street. According to the regulations, every cab driver was supposed to take you anywhere you wanted to go, but the drivers in the line at 79th and 1st wouldn't budge unless you were going down to Wall Street or close to it. From the cab stand, they swung two blocks east and then went down along the East River on the highway, the FDR, the Franklin Delano Roosevelt Drive. It was a $10 ride each morning, but what was that to a master of the universe? Sherman's father had always taken the subway to Wall Street, even when he was the chief executive officer of Dunning Spungit and Leach. Even now, at the age of 71, when he took his daily excursions to Dunning Spungit to breathe the same air as his lawyer cronies for 3 or 4 hours, he went by subway. It was a matter of principle. The more grim the subways became, the more graffiti those people scrawled on the cars, the more gold chains they snatched off girls' necks, the more old men they mugged, the more women they pushed in front of the trains, the more determined was John Campbell McCoy that they weren't going to drive him off the New York City subways. But to the new breed, the young breed, the masterful breed, Sherman's breed, there was no such principle. Insulation. That was the ticket. That was the term Raleigh Thorpe used. "If you want to live in New York," he once told Sherman, "you've got to insulate, insulate, insulate," meaning insulate yourself from those people. The cynicism and smugness of the idea struck Sherman as very au courant. If you could go breezing down the FDR Drive in a taxi, then why file into the trenches of the urban wars? The driver was a Turk? An Armenian? Sherman tried to make out his name on the card in the frame on the dashboard. Once the taxi reached the drive, he settled back to read the Times. There was a picture on the front page of a mob of people on a stage and the mayor standing near a podium staring at them. The riot, no doubt. He began to read the story, but his mind wandered. The sun was beginning to break through the clouds. He could see it on the river off to his left. At this moment, the poor, filthy river sparkled. It was a sunny day in May, after all. Up ahead, the towers of New York Hospital rose straight up from the edge of the highway. There was a sign for the East 71st Street exit, the one his father had always taken when they drove back from Southampton on Sunday evenings. The very sight of the hospital and the exit made Sherman think of, no, not so much think of, as feel, the house on 73rd Street with its knickerbocker green rooms. He had grown up in those pale, grayish-green rooms and trudged up and down those four flights of narrow stairs, believing that he was living in the height of elegance, in the household of the mighty John Campbell McCoy, the lion of Dunning, Spungen, and Leach. Only recently had it dawned on him that back in 1948, when his parents had bought and renovated that house, they had been a mildly adventurous young couple, tackling what at the time was an old wreck in a down-at-the-heels block, keeping a stern eye on costs every step of the way, and taking pride in what a proper house they had created for a relatively modest amount. Christ! If his father ever found out how much he had paid for his apartment and how he had financed it, he'd have a stroke. $2,600,000, with $1,800,000 of it borrowed. $21,000 a month in principal and interest with a $1 million balloon payment due in 2 years. The lion of Dunning Spungen would be appalled, and worse than appalled, wounded at the thought of how his endlessly repeated lessons concerning duty, debt, ostentation, and proportion had whistled straight through his son's skull. Had his father ever played around? It wasn't out of the question. He was a handsome man. He had the chin. Yet Sherman couldn't imagine it. And by the time he saw the Brooklyn Bridge up ahead, he had stopped trying to. In a few minutes, he would be on Wall Street. The investment banking firm of Pierce & Pierce occupied the 50th, 51st, 52nd, 53rd, and 54th floors of a glass tower that rose up 60 stories from out of the gloomy groin of Wall Street. The bond trading room, where Sherman worked, was on the 50th. Every day he stepped out of an aluminum-walled elevator into what looked like the reception area of one of those new London hotels catering to the Yanks. Near the elevator door was a fake fireplace and an antique mahogany mantelpiece with great bunches of fruit carved on each corner. Out in front of the fake fireplace was a brass fence, or fender, as they called it in country homes in the west of England. In the appropriate months, a fake fire glowed within, casting flickering lights upon a prodigious pair of brass andirons. The wall surrounding it was covered in more mahogany, rich and reddish, done in linen-fold panels carved so deep you could feel the expense in the tips of your fingers by just looking at them. All of this reflected the passion of Pierce & Pierce's chief executive officer, Eugene Lopwitz, for things British. Things British. Library ladders, bow-front consoles, Sheraton legs, Chippendale backs, cigar cutters, tufted club chairs, Wilton weave carpet, were multiplying on the 50th floor at Pierce & Pierce day by day. Alas, there wasn't much Eugene Lopwitz could do about the ceiling, which was barely 8 feet above the floor. The floor had been raised 1 foot. Beneath it ran enough cables and wires to electrify Guatemala. The wires provided the power for the computer terminals and telephones of the bond trading room. The ceiling had been lowered 1 foot to make room for light housings and air conditioning ducts and a few more miles of wire. The floor had risen, the ceiling had descended. It was as if you were in an English mansion that had been squashed. No sooner did you pass the fake fireplace than you heard an ungodly roar, like the roar of a mob. It came from somewhere around the corner. You couldn't miss it. Sherman McCoy headed straight for it with relish. On this particular morning, as on every morning, it resonated with his very gizzard. He turned the corner and there it was, the bond trading room of Pierce & Pierce. It was a vast space, perhaps 60 by 80 feet, but with the same 8-foot ceiling bearing down on your head. It was an oppressive space, with a ferocious glare, writhing silhouettes, and the roar. The glare came from a wall of plate glass that faced south, looking out over New York Harbor, the Statue of Liberty, Staten Island, and the Brooklyn and New Jersey shores. The writhing silhouettes were the arms and torsos of young men, few of them older than 40. They had their suit jackets off. They were moving about in an agitated manner and sweating early in the morning and shouting, which created the roar. It was the sound of well-educated young white men baying for money on the bond market. "Pick up your fucking phone, please!" A chubby, pink-faced member of the Harvard class of 1976 screamed at someone 2 rows of desks away. The room was like a newspaper city room, in that there were no partitions and no signs of visible rank. Everyone sat at light gray metal desks in front of veal-colored computer terminals with black screens. Rows of green diode letters and numbers came skidding across. "I said, please pick up the fucking phone. I mean, holy shit!" There were dark half-moons in the armpits of his shirt, and the day had just begun. A member of the Yale class of 1973, with a neck that seemed to protrude 12 inches out of his shirt, stared at a screen and screamed over the telephone at a broker in Paris. "If you can't see the fucking screen, oh, for Christ's sake, Jean-Pierre, that's the buyer's $5 million, the buyer's! Nothing further's coming in!" Then he covered the telephone with his hand and looked straight up at the ceiling and said out loud to no one, except Mammon, "The frogs, the fucking frogs!" 4 desks away, a member of the Stanford class of 1979 was sitting down, staring at a sheet of paper on his desk and holding a telephone to his ear. His right foot was up on the stirrup of a portable shoeshine stand, and a black man named Felix, who was about 50, or was he about 60, was humped over his foot, stropping his shoe with a high-shine rag. All day long, Felix moved from desk to desk, shining the shoes of young bond traders and salesmen as they worked, at $3 per, counting the tip. Seldom was a word exchanged. Felix scarcely registered on their maculae. Just then, Stanford 79 rose from his chair, his eyes still fastened on the sheet of paper, the telephone still at his ear, and his right foot still on the shoeshine stirrup, and he shouted, "Well then, why do you think everybody's stripping the fucking 20 years? Never took his foot off the shoeshine stand. What powerful legs he must have, thought Sherman. Sherman sat down before his own telephone and computer terminals. The shouts, the imprecations, the gesticulations, the fucking fear and greed enveloped him, and he loved it. He was the number one bond salesman, the biggest producer, as the phrase went, in the bond trading room of Pierce & Pierce on the 50th floor, and he loved the very roar of the storm. This Goldman order really fucked things up good. "Step up to the fucking plate and bid 8.5. I'm away by 2:30. Somebody's painting you a fucking picture, can't you see that? I'll take an order and buy him at 6+. Hit the 5-year. Sell 5. You couldn't do 10? You think this thing continues up? Strip fever in the 20-year. That's all these jerks keep talking about. $100 million July 90s at the buck. Naked short. Jesus Christ, what's going on? I don't fucking believe this. Holy fucking shit!" shouted the Yale men and the Harvard men and the Stanford men. "Holy fucking shit!" How these sons of the great universities, these legatees of Jefferson, Emerson, Thoreau, William James, Frederick Jackson Turner, William Lyons Phelps, Samuel Flagg Bemis, and the other 3 named giants of American scholarship, how these inheritors of the Lux and the Veritas now flock to Wall Street and to the bond trading room of Pierce and Pierce. how the stories circulated on every campus. If you weren't making $250,000 a year within 5 years, then you were either grossly stupid or grossly lazy. That was the word. By age 30, $500,000, and that sum had the taint of the mediocre. By age 40, you were either making $1 million a year or you were timid and incompetent. Make it now. That motto burned in every heart, like myocarditis. Boys on Wall Street, mere boys, with smooth jawlines and clean arteries, boys still able to blush, were buying $3 million apartments on Park and Fifth. Why wait? They were buying 30-room, 4-acre summer places in Southampton, places built in the 1920s and written off in the 1950s as white elephants, places with decaying servants' wings, and they were doing over the servants' wings, too, and even adding on. Why not? We've got the servants. They had carnival rides trucked in and installed on the great green lawns for their children's birthday parties, complete with teams of carnival workers to operate them. A thriving little industry. And where did all of this astonishing new money come from? Sherman had heard Gene Lopwitz discourse on that subject. In the Lopwitz analysis, they had Lyndon Johnson to thank. Ever so quietly, the U.S. had started printing money by the billions to finance the war in Vietnam. Before anyone, even Johnson, knew what was happening, a worldwide inflation had begun. Everyone woke up to it when the Arabs suddenly jacked up oil prices in the early 1970s. In no time, markets of all sorts became heaving crapshoots. Gold, silver, copper, currencies, bank certificates, corporate notes, even bonds. For decades, the bond business had been the bedridden giant of Wall Street. At firms such as Salomon Brothers, Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs, and Pearson Pierce, twice as much money had always changed hands on the bond market as on the stock market. But prices had budged by only pennies at a time, and mostly they went down. As Lopwitz put it, "The bond market has been going down ever since the Battle of Midway." The Battle of Midway, Sherman had to look it up, was in the Second World War. The Pearson Pierce bond department had consisted of only 20 souls, 20 rather dull souls, known as the bond bores. The less promising members of the firm were steered into bonds, where they could do no harm. Sherman resisted the thought that it had been even thus when he entered the bond department. Well, there was no more talk about bond bores these days. Oh no, not at all. The bond market had caught fire. And experienced salesmen such as himself were all at once much in demand. All of a sudden, in investment houses all over Wall Street, the erstwhile bond bores were making so much money they took to congregating after work in a bar on Hanover Square called Harry's to tell war stories and assure one another this wasn't dumb luck, but rather a surge of collective talent. Bonds now represented 4/5 of Pearson Pierce's business, and the young hotshots, the Yaleys, Harvards, and Stanfords, were desperate to get to the bond trading room of Pearson Pierce, and at this very moment their voices ricocheted off Eugene Lopwitz's linen-fold mahogany walls. Masters of the universe! The roar filled Sherman's soul with hope, confidence, esprit de corps, and righteousness. Yes, righteousness! Judy understood none of this, did she? None of it. Oh, he noticed her eyes glazing over when he talked about it. Moving the lever that moves the world was what he was doing, and all she wanted to know was why he never made it home for dinner. When he did make it home for dinner, what did she want to talk about? Her precious interior decorating business and how she had gotten their apartment into Architectural Digest, which, frankly, to a true Wall Streeter was a fucking embarrassment. Did she commend him for the hundreds of thousands of dollars that made her decorating and her lunches and whatever the hell else she did possible? No, she did not. She took it for granted. And so forth and so on. Within 90 seconds, emboldened by the mighty roar of the bond trading room of Pearson Pierce, Sherman managed to work up a good righteous head of resentment against this woman who had dared make him feel guilty. He picked up the telephone and was ready to resume work on the greatest coup of his young career, the Giscard, when he spotted something out of the corner of his eye. He detected it righteously amid that great bondscape of writhing limbs and torsos. Arguello was reading a newspaper. Ferdinand Arguello was a junior bond salesman, 25 or 26 years old, from Argentina. He was leaning back in his chair, nonchalantly reading a newspaper, and even from here Sherman could see what it was. The racing form. The racing form. The young man looked like a caricature of a South American polo player. He was slender and handsome. He had thick, wavy black hair combed straight back. He was wearing a pair of red silk moiré suspenders. Silk moiré. The bond department of Pierce & Pierce was like an Air Force fighter squadron. Sherman knew it, even if this young South American didn't. As the number one bond salesman, Sherman had no official rank. Nevertheless, he occupied a moral eminence. You were either capable of doing the job and willing to devote 100% to the job, or you got out. The 80 members of the department received a base salary, a safety net, of $120,000 a year each. This was regarded as a laughably small sum. The rest of their income came from commissions and profit sharing. 65% of the department's profits went to Pierce & Pierce, but 35% was split among the 80 bond salesmen and traders themselves. All for one and one for all, and lots for oneself. And therefore, no slackers allowed, no deadwood, no lightweights, no loafers. You headed straight for your desk, your telephone, and your computer terminal in the morning. The day didn't start with small talk and coffee and perusals of the Wall Street Journal and the financial pages of the Times, much less the racing form. You were expected to get on the telephone and start making money. If you left the office, even for lunch, you were expected to give your destination and a telephone number to one of the sales assistants, who were really secretaries, so that you could be summoned immediately if a new issue of bonds came in and had to be sold fast. If you went out for lunch, it better have something directly to do with selling bonds for Pierce & Pierce. Otherwise, sit here by the telephone and order in from the deli like the rest of the squadron. Sherman walked to Arguello's desk and stood over him.
"What are you doing, Ferdy?"
From the moment the young man looked up, Sherman could tell he knew what the question meant, and that he knew he was wrong. But if there was one thing an Argentine aristocrat knew, it was how to brazen it out. Arguello locked a level gaze onto Sherman's eyes and said in a voice just slightly louder than necessary,
"I'm reading the racing form."
"What for?"
"What for? Because four of our horses are racing at Lafayette today. That's a track outside of Chicago."
With this, he resumed reading the newspaper. It was the hour that did it. Hour was supposed to remind you that you were in the presence of the House of Arguello, Lords of the Pampas. Besides that, the little shit was wearing a pair of red silk moiré suspenders.
"Look, sport," said Sherman. "I want you to put that sheet away."
Challengingly.
"What did you say?"
"You heard me. I said, put that fucking sheet away."
It was supposed to come out calmly and firmly, but it came out furiously. It came out furiously enough to finish off Judy, Pollard Browning, the doorman, and a would-be mugger. The young man was speechless.
"If I ever see you with a racing form in here again, you can go sit outside Chicago and make your money. You can sit on the clubhouse turn and bet perfectas. This is Pierce and Pierce, not OTB.
Arguello was crimson. He was paralyzed with anger. All he could do was beam a ray of pure hatred at Sherman. Sherman, the righteous, wrathful one, turned away, and as he did, he noticed with satisfaction that the young man was slowly closing the open expanse of the racing form. Wrathful, righteous. Sherman was elated. People were staring. Good. Idleness was a sin, not against the self or against God, but against Mammon and Pierce & Pierce. If he had to be the one to call this greaseball to accounts, then... But he regretted the greaseball, even in his thoughts.
He considered himself as part of the new era, and the new breed, a Wall Street egalitarian, a master of the universe who was a respecter only of performance. No longer did Wall Street or Pearson Pierce mean Protestant good family. There were plenty of prominent Jewish investment bankers. Lopwitz himself was Jewish. There were plenty of Irishmen, Greeks, and Slavs. The fact that not one of the 80 members of the bond department was black or female didn't bother him. Why should it? It didn't bother Lopwitz, who took the position that the bond trading room at Pearson Pierce was no place for symbolic gestures.
"Hey, Sherman."
He happened to be passing Raleigh Thorpe's desk. Raleigh was bald, except for a fringe of hair around the back of his head, and yet he still looked youthful. He was a great wearer of button-down shirts and Shep Miller suspenders. The button-down collars had a flawless roll. "What was that all about?" he asked Sherman.
"I couldn't believe it," said Sherman. "He's over there with a racing form, working on fucking horse charts."
He felt compelled to embellish the offense a bit. Raleigh started laughing.
"Well, he's young. He's probably had it with electric donuts."
"Had it with what?" Raleigh picked up his telephone and pointed to the mouthpiece.
"See that? That's an electric donut."
Sherman stared. It did look sort of like a donut, with a lot of little holes instead of one big one.
"It just dawned on me today," said Raleigh. "All I do all day is talk to other electric donuts. I just hung up from talking to a guy over at Drexel. I sold him 1.5 million Joshua Tree bonds."
"On Wall Street, you didn't say $1.5 million worth of bonds. You said 1.5 million bonds."
"That's some goddamn outfit in Arizona. His name is Earl. I don't even know his last name. Over the past 2 years, I bet I've done a couple dozen transactions with him. 50, 60 million bonds, and I don't even know his last name. And I've never met him, and I probably never will. He's an electric donut."
Sherman didn't find this amusing. In some way, it was a repudiation of his triumph over the shiftless young Argentinian. It was a cynical denial of his very righteousness itself. Raleigh was a very amusing man, but he hadn't been himself since his divorce. Maybe he was no longer such a great squadron warrior either.
"Yeah," said Sherman, managing a half-smile for his old friend. "Well, I gotta go call some of my donuts."
Back at his desk, Sherman settled down to the work at hand. He stared at the little green symbols trucking across the computer screen in front of him. He picked up the telephone. The French gold-backed bond. A weird, very promising situation, and he had discovered it when one of the fellows quite casually mentioned the bond in passing one evening at Harry's. Back in the innocent year, 1973, on the eve of the heaving crapshoot, the French government had issued a bond known as the Giscard, after the French president, Giscard d'Estaing, with a face value of $6.5 billion. The Giscard had an interesting feature. It was backed by gold. So, as the price of gold went up and down, so did the price of the Giscard. Since then, the price of both gold and the French franc had shot up and down so crazily American investors had long since lost interest in the Giscard. But lately, with gold holding firm in the $400 range, Sherman had discovered that an American buying Giscard stood to make 2 to 3 times the interest he could make on any U.S. government bond, plus a 30% profit when the Giscard matured. It was a sleeping beauty. The big danger would be a drop in the value of the franc. Sherman had neutralized that with a scheme for selling francs short as a hedge. The only real problem was the complexity of the whole thing. It took big, sophisticated investors to understand it. Big, sophisticated, trusting investors. No newcomer could talk anybody into putting millions into the Giscard. You had to have a track record. You had to have talent, genius, mastery of the universe. Like Sherman McCoy, biggest producer at Pearson Pierce. He had convinced Gene Lopwitz to put up $600 million of Pearson Pierce's money to buy the Giscard. Gingerly, stealthily, he had bought the bonds from their various European owners without revealing the mighty hand of Pierce and Pierce by using various blind brokers. Now came the big test for a master of the universe. There were only about a dozen players who were likely buyers of anything as esoteric as the Giscard. Of these, Sherman had managed to start negotiations with five. Two trust banks, Traders Trust Company, known as Trader T, and Metroland, two money managers, and one of his best private clients, Oscar Souter of Cleveland, who had indicated he would buy $10 million. But by far the most important was Trader T, which was considering taking half the entire lot, $300 million. The deal would bring Pierce & Pierce a 1% commission up front, $6 million, for conceiving of the idea and risking its capital. Sherman's share, including commissions, bonuses, profit sharing, and resale fees, would come to about $1.75 million. With that, he intended to pay off the horrendous $1.8 million personal loan he had taken out to buy the apartment. So the first order of business today was a call to Bernard Levy, a Frenchman, who was handling the deal at Trader T. A relaxed, friendly call, the call of a biggest producing salesman, master of the universe, to remind Levy that although both gold and the franc had fallen in value yesterday and this morning on the European exchanges, it meant nothing. All was well, very well indeed. It was true that he had met Bernard Levy only once, when he made the original presentation. They had been conferring on the telephone for months, but electric donut? Cynicism was such a cowardly form of superiority. That was Raleigh's great weakness. Raleigh cashed his checks. He wasn't too cynical to do that. If he wanted to belly up because he couldn't deal with his wife, that was his sad problem. As Sherman dialed and waited for Bernard Levy to come on the line, the rousing sound of the greed storm closed in about him once again. From the desk right in front of his, a tall, bug-eyed fellow, Yale 77,
31 bid January 88.
From a desk somewhere behind him,
I'm short 70 million 10-year.
From he knew not where,
they got their fucking buying shoes on. I'm in a box. Long 125. A million 4 years from Midland. Who's fucking around with the WIs? I tell you, I'm in the box. Bid 80.5. Buy him at 6+. Pick up 2.5 basis points. Forget it. It's nut-cutting time.
At 10 o'clock, Sherman, Raleigh, and five others convened in the conference room of Eugene Lopwitz's suite of offices to decide on Pierce & Pierce's strategy for the main event of the day in the bond markets, which was a U.S. Treasury auction of 10 billion bonds maturing in 20 years. It was a measure of the importance of the bond business to Pierce & Pierce that Lopwitz's offices opened right out into the bond trading room. The conference room had no conference table. It looked like the lounge in the English Hotel for the Yanks where they serve tea. It was full of small antique tables and cabinets. They were so old, brittle, and highly polished, you got the feeling that if you flicked one of them hard with your middle finger, it would shatter. At the same time, a wall of plate glass shoved a view of the Hudson River and the rotting piers of New Jersey into your face. Sherman sat in a George II armchair. Raleigh sat next to him, in an old chair with a back shaped like a shield. In other antique or antiqued chairs, with Sheraton and Chippendale side tables beside them, were the head government trader, George Connor, who was 2 years younger than Sherman, his deputy, Vic Scassi, who was only 28, the chief market analyst, Paul Pfeiffer, and Arnold Parch, the executive vice president, who was Lopwitz's first lieutenant. Everyone in the room sat in a classic chair and stared at a small brown plastic speaker on top of a cabinet. The cabinet was a 220-year-old Adam Beaufront, from the period when the brothers Adam liked to paint pictures and ornate borders on wooden furniture. On the center panel was an oval-shaped painting of a Greek maiden sitting in a dell or grotto in which lacy leaves receded fuzzily in deepening shades of green into a dusky, teal sky. The thing had cost an astonishing amount of money. The plastic speaker was the size of a bedside clock radio. Everyone stared at it, waiting for the voice of Jean Lopwitz. Lopwitz was in London, where it was now 4 p.m. He would preside over this meeting by telephone. An indistinct noise came out of the speaker. It might have been a voice, and it might have been an airplane. Arnold Parch rose from his armchair and approached the Adam cabinet and looked at the plastic speaker and said, "Jane, can you hear me all right?" He looked imploringly at the plastic speaker, without taking his eyes off it, as if, in fact, it were Jean Lopwitz, transformed, the way princes are transformed into frogs in fairy tales. For a moment, the plastic frog said nothing. Then it spoke.
"Yeah, I can hear you, Arnie. There was a lot of cheering going on."
Lopwitz's voice sounded as if it were coming from out of a storm drain, but you could hear it.
"Where are you, Jean?" asked Parch. "I'm at a cricket match."
Then less clearly,
"What's the name of this place again?"
He was evidently with some other people.
"Tottenham Park, Arnie. I'm on a kind of a terrace." "Who's playing?"
Parch smiled, as if to show the plastic frog that this wasn't a serious question.
"Don't get technical on me, Arnie. A lot of very nice young gentlemen in cable knit sweaters and white flannel pants is the best I can tell you."
Appreciative laughter broke out in the room, and Sherman felt his own lips bending into the somehow obligatory smile. He glanced about the room. Everyone was smiling and chuckling at the brown plastic speaker except for Raleigh, who had his eyes rolled up in the "oh, brother" mode. Then Raleigh leaned over toward Sherman and said in a noisy whisper,
"Look at all these idiots grinning. They think the plastic box has eyes."
This didn't strike Sherman as very funny, since he himself had been grinning. He was also afraid that Lopwitz's loyal aide, Parch, would think he was Raleigh's confederate in making sport of the maximum leader.
"Well, everybody's here, Jane," Parch said to the box, "and so I'm going to get George to fill you in on where we stand on the auction as of now."
Parch looked at George Connor and nodded and walked back to his chair. And Connor got up from his and walked over to the Adam cabinet and stared at the brown plastic box and said,
"Jane, this is George."
"Yeah, hi, George,"
said the frog.
"Go ahead."
"Here's the thing, Jane," said Connor, standing in front of the Adam commode, unable to take his eyes off the plastic box. "It feels pretty good. The old 20s are trading at 8%. The traders are telling us they'll come in on the new ones at 8.05, but we think they're playing games with us. We think we're going to get action right down to 8. So here's what I figure. We'll scale in at 8.01, 8.02, 8.03, with the balance at 8.04. I'm ready to go 60% of the issue."
Which, translated, meant he was proposing to buy $6 billion of the $10 billion in bonds offered in the auction, with the expectation of a profit of 2/32 of a dollar, 6¼ cents, on every $100 put up. This was known as 2 ticks. Sherman couldn't resist another look at Raleigh. He had a small, unpleasant smile on his face, and his gaze seemed to pass several degrees to the right of the Adam commode toward the Hoboken docks. Raleigh's presence was like a glass of ice water in the face. Sherman resented him all over again. He knew what was on his mind. Here was this outrageous arriviste, Lopwitz, Sherman knew Raleigh thought of him that way, trying to play the knob on the terrace of some British cricket club and at the same time conduct a meeting in New York to decide whether Pearson Pierce was going to stake $2 billion, $4 billion, or $6 billion on a single government bond issue 3 hours from now. No doubt Lopwitz had his own audience on hand at the cricket club to watch this performance, as his great words bounced off a communication satellite somewhere up in the Empyrean and hit Wall Street. Well, it wasn't hard to find something laughable in it, but Lopwitz was, in truth, a master of the universe. Lopwitz was about 45 years old. Sherman wanted nothing less 7 years down the line when he was 45, to be astride the Atlantic, with billions at stake. Raleigh could snigger, and sink into his kneecaps, but to think what Lopwitz now had in his grasp, to think what he made each year just from Pierce and Pierce, which was at least $25 million, to think of the kind of life he led, and what Sherman thought of first was Lopwitz's young wife, Snow White. That was what Raleigh called her. Hair as dark as ebony, lips as red as blood, skin as white as snow. She was Lopwitz's fourth wife, French, a countess, apparently, no more than 25 or 26, with an accent like Catherine Deneuve doing a bath oil commercial. She was something. Sherman had met her at a party at the Petersons. She had put her hand on his forearm, just to make a point in conversation, but the way she kept the pressure on his arm and stared at him from about 8 inches away. She was a young and frisky animal. Lopwitz had taken what he wanted. He had wanted a young and frisky animal with lips as red as blood and skin as white as snow, and that was what he had taken. What had ever happened to the other three Mrs. Eugene Lopwitzes was a question Sherman had never heard brought up. When you had reached Lopwitz's level, it didn't even matter.
"Yeah, well, that sounds all right, George," said the plastic frog. "What about Sherman? Are you there, Sherman?"
"Hi, Jane," said Sherman, rising from the George II armchair.
His own voice sounded very odd to him, now that he was talking to a plastic box, and he didn't dare even take a quick glance at Raleigh as he walked over to the Atom commode and took his stance and stared, rapt, at the machine on top.
"Jane, all my customers are talking 8.05. My gut feeling, though, is that they're on our side. The market has a good tone. I think we can bid ahead of the customer interest."
"Okay," said the voice in the box. "But just make sure you and George stay on top of the trading accounts. I don't want to hear about Salomon or anybody horsing around with shorts."
Sherman found himself marveling at the frog's wisdom. Some sort of throttled roar came over the speaker. Everybody stared at it. Lopwitz's voice returned.
"Somebody just hit the hell out of the ball," he said. "The ball's kind of dead, though. Well, you kind of had to be there."
It wasn't clear what he meant by that.
"Well, look, George. Can you hear me, George?"
Connor hopped to it, rose from his chair, hustled over to the Atom commode.
"I can hear you, Jane. I was just going to say, if you feel like stepping up to the plate and taking a good whack at it today, go ahead. It sounds okay."
And that was that. At 45 seconds before the auction deadline of 1 p.m., George Connor, at a telephone in the middle of the bond trading room, read off his final scaled-in bids to a Pierce & Pierce functionary sitting at a telephone at the Federal Building, which was the physical site of the auction. The bids averaged $99.62643 per $100 worth of bonds. Within a few seconds after 1 p.m., Pierce & Pierce now owned, as planned, $6 billion worth of the 20-year bond. The bond department had 4 hours in which to create a favorable market. Vic Scazzi led the charge on the bond trading desk, reselling the bonds mainly to the brokerage houses, by telephone. Sherman and Raleigh led the bond salesmen, reselling the bonds mainly to insurance companies and trust banks, by telephone. By 2 p.m., the roar in the bond trading room, fueled more by fear than greed, was unearthly. They all shouted and sweated and swore and devoured their electric donuts. By 5 p.m., they had sold 40%, $2.4 billion of the $6 billion at an average price of $99.75062 per $100 worth of bonds for a profit of not two, but four ticks. Four ticks. That was a profit of 12.5 cents per $100. Four ticks. To the eventual retail buyer of these bonds, whether an individual, a corporation, or an institution, this spread was invisible. But four ticks. To Pierce and Pierce, it meant a profit of almost $3 million for an afternoon's work. And it wouldn't stop there. The market was holding firm and edging up. Within the next week, they might easily make an additional $5 to $10 million on the $3.6 billion bonds remaining. Four ticks. By 5 o'clock, Sherman was soaring on adrenaline. He was part of the pulverizing might of Pierce and Pierce, masters of the universe. The audacity of it all was breathtaking. To risk $6 billion in one afternoon to make 2 ticks, 6¼ cents per $100, and then to make 4 ticks, 4 ticks. The audacity, the audacity. Was there any more exciting power on the face of the earth? Let Lopwitz watch all the cricket matches he wants to. Let him play the plastic frog, master of the universe. The audacity. The audacity of it flowed through Sherman's limbs and lymph channels and loins. Pearson Pierce was the power, and he was wired into the power, and the power hummed and surged in his very innards. Judy. He hadn't thought of her for hours. What was a single, albeit boneheaded, telephone call on the stupendous ledger kept by Pierce and Pierce? The 50th floor was for people who weren't afraid to take what they wanted, and Christ, he didn't want much compared to what he, a master of the universe, should rightfully have. All he wanted was to be able to kick the gong around when he pleased, to have the simple pleasures do all mighty warriors. Where did she get off giving him such a hard time? If middle age wishes the continued support and escort of a master of the universe, then she must allow him the precious currency he has earned, which is youth and beauty and juicy jugs and loamy loins. It made no sense. Somehow, for no explicable reason, Judy had always had his number. She looked down on him, from a wholly fictive elevation. Nevertheless, she looked down on him. Still the daughter of Professor Miller, E. for Egg Board, Ronald Miller, of DePort University, Terwilliger, Wisconsin. Poor, stodgy Professor Miller, in his rotting tweeds, whose one claim to fame was a rather mealy-mouthed attack, Sherman had once plowed through it, on his fellow Wisconsinite, Senator Joseph McCarthy, in the magazine Aspects, in 1955. Yet, back there in the cocoon of their early days together in the village, Sherman had validated her claim. He had enjoyed telling Judy that while he worked on Wall Street, he was not of Wall Street, and was only using Wall Street. He had been pleased when she condescended to admire him for the enlightenment that was stirring in his soul. Somehow she was assuring him that his own father, John Campbell McCoy, the Lion of Dunning Spunget, was a rather pedestrian figure after all, a high-class security guard for other people's capital. As to why that might be important to him, Sherman didn't even know how to speculate. His interest in psychoanalytical theory, never lively, had ended one day at Yale when Raleigh Thorpe had referred to it as a Jewish science, precisely the attitude that had most troubled and infuriated Freud 75 years earlier. But that was all part of the past, of his childhood on East 73rd Street, and his childhood in the village. This was a new era. This was a new Wall Street, and Judy was an article left over from his childhood. And yet she lived on and grew older, thinner, handsome. Sherman leaned back in his chair and surveyed the bond trading room. The processions of phosphorescent green characters still skidded across the faces of the computer terminals, but the roar had subsided to something more like locker room laughter. George Connor stood beside Vic Scozzi's chair with his hands in his pockets, just chatting. Vic arched his back and rolled his shoulders and seemed about to yawn. There was Raleigh, reared back in his chair, talking on the telephone, grinning and running his hand over his bald pate. Victorious warriors after the fray, masters of the universe. And she has the gall to cause him grief over a telephone call? Chapter 4 King of the Jungle. Thumpa 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 thumpa. The noise of the airliners taking off pounded down so hard he could feel it. The air was full of jet fumes. The stench cut straight through to his stomach. Cars kept popping up from out of the mouth of a ramp and threading their way through the swarms of people who were roaming about on the roof in the dusk, looking for the elevators or their cars or other people's cars. Steel, steel, steel. And his would be the leading candidate, wouldn't it? Sherman stood with one hand resting on the door, wondering if he dared leave it here. The car was a black Mercedes two-seat sports roadster that had cost $48,000. Or